It's very apparent to me that I confused more people than I helped about the lesson 6 and lesson 7 thing that I just said. Would you look down at the bottom of page 10? I'll try to clear this up for you. This is on lesson 6, bottom of page 10. The nail said, stay tuned. And so the whole next session you were staying tuned and didn't know what you were supposed to be hearing, staying tuned. And if you go over to lesson 7 on page 11, point D, Solomon's conclusion, once again in light of life's fluctuations, Solomon issues a twofold call to one, simplicity and dependency. That's the nail that should go in the, I mean, that you would put in the bottom of 6 if I intended for you to have anything in that except stay tuned. That makes, I probably ought to just take that out. It's probably confusing. But anyway, Solomon's conclusion in chapter, in session 7 is what I intended for us to be thinking about or anticipating, I guess is a better way to put it. If that still muddies the water, don't worry about it. You won't miss anything. And if you just understand what we taught, you won't miss anything. But sometimes, not anybody here, but there are blank freaks who, if you left out something, they wouldn't sleep. That's part of that anxiety. They're dissatisfied because, you know, that. And I'm not talking about anybody who mentioned this to me. They were mentioning it to me because other people might have that problem and they wanted to be helpful. Now, I'm not implying anything about them at all either. So, they're my friends. Okay, lesson 9. If you know so much, how could you forget the batteries? That's right in the Hebrew there too, you'll see. As a little boy, of course, being a boy, we like, my brothers and I like trucks and tractors and things like that. And we had some great Tonka tractor trucks and back then all of the trucks and the tractors were metal. And there weren't plastic things back in those days. Plastic was just being found out, I think, back in the early 50s. But you know, when battery-operated toys came along, we always really, you know, we wanted some of these battery-operated toys. Like the filling stations would have, they would have trucks that looked like this. And you'd go into the filling station, there would just be stacks of these trucks, and we would want a truck like this. This is a Hess truck. And Dad, being the frugal utilitarian mechanic that he was, wasn't at all interested in buying us something that would take batteries, because you just have to keep buying more. But you know, if you have a truck like this with batteries in it, then the lights work and the horn toots and it makes engine sounds, and I mean, it's a really neat thing. You don't have to go that kind of stuff, because it does it just by itself. And so I've always been on the point of despair because I was dissatisfied that I didn't ever have one of these trucks like this. Well, when I was teaching this to our Sunday school here years ago, I used that illustration about, you know, always wanting one of those. And bless his heart, Joe Cook bought this Hess truck for me. So now I have one. It's an 18-wheeler, and it has two race cars in the back, and it takes 2D batteries, and the lights blink, and the horn sounds. And, I mean, it's a great thing. And someday I'll let Bobby play with it if he's careful. The lesson from Ecclesiastes is this. You can collect all your toys, but God dispenses the batteries. And what that means is that you can collect all of these toys, but if God doesn't give the batteries to energize them, the toys won't do for you what you think they would do for you. And if it sounds like we're saying the same old thing we've said all week long, that's true, because Solomon is just driving this point home over and over and over again, although he didn't quote anything about batteries. This is the conclusion of Discourse 3, The Secret of Prosperity. So we have seen here some of the themes is that prosperity isn't always good. It has its own pain. Prosperity has its own pain unless we learn contentment. And pain isn't always bad, because like things like funerals and rebukes and patience are good for us, even though they're painful. And the theme that he's going to drive home in this section of this discourse is that wisdom is always profitable. These batteries will always make things work. Wisdom is always profitable. In fact, he's going to tell us that wisdom is better than prosperity. In chapter 7, in verse 11, he says, "Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it, by wisdom, there is profit to them that see the sun." Wisdom is profitable. So we have to ask ourselves, what is wisdom? And I want to quote a couple of pages from Change Into His Image, page 165 to 167, if you want to look it up later. What is wisdom? Before we look at the actual disciplines of wisdom, hearing and doing, we do that later in the book. We need to have in our minds a good idea of what wisdom is. We want to avoid some misconceptions about it. Some people have the idea that possessing wisdom is having some kind of bird's eye view of all that God is doing in the world, and particularly in our own lives. They think of wisdom as a view of the rush hour traffic snarl from the traffic helicopter. From that vantage point, the pilot and news broadcaster can view the whole area and can see the exact cause and effect of every automobile's activity. It is not uncommon for people who have the helicopter view of wisdom to become quite discouraged when they come to a crisis and cannot see the whole picture. Example, Carolyn was quite distraught when complications developed during her infant son's surgery to correct a birth defect. Her anxiety went beyond the normal motherly love and concern for her baby. She began to question her own walk with God. She was known in her circle of friends as a spiritually minded woman and seemed to know how to interpret the circumstances of life to know what God was trying to do. Now that's, folks, that's a very dangerous thing for us to get into, to try to interpret from the circumstances of life what God is trying to do. You put yourself very close to being a gypsy looking at your crystal ball. We can see what God is doing and that he stopped this or he did that or he has done this, but we don't always know what he is doing except in one area, and we'll come to that. She said, "I could see how God was using my own illness last year to teach me more of his love and care, but I can't see any good that will come out of this for little Timmy. What is he going to learn? He's only 8 months old, and why would God do something to Timmy to teach me anything? It seems that God should be doing something to me, not my son, if he wants to teach me something." God is doing something to her. We can all certainly understand Carolyn's concern for her son's welfare and perhaps even identify with her questions. By the way, Patty and I were discussing this on the way over here. All of us are theologians, folks. Anytime you ask the question why, you have just become a theologian if you try to answer it. The problem is, all of our theology doesn't match the scriptures. And we can understand her concern. Part of the struggle Carolyn is having, however, is a result of her faulty view of wisdom and godliness. She truly believes that if she is walking with God, she will understand the whys and wherefores of everything that happens in her life. If she cannot figure out how all things work together for good in her life, she feels that somehow she has disqualified herself from some inner circle with God where he shares all the secrets of his providence. A quick survey of scriptures will reveal, however, that most of God's saints never knew much of his plan at all. That certainly was the case with Abraham, who was told to leave home and just follow God. It was the experience of Joseph, Daniel, Job, and hosts of others as well. Very seldom did they have a big picture of God's providence. Wisdom, then, is not the view of the road from the helicopter above the traffic snarl. The next section is called The View from the Dashboard. A more fitting illustration of wisdom is to view it as the skill exercised by a driver caught in the middle of the traffic snarl. He must know the next right response when someone slams on the brakes in front of him or cuts him off unexpectedly or when a child lets out a blood-curdling scream in the back seat. His response to dilemmas like these reveal his real skill or wisdom as a driver. Wisdom isn't knowing the overall view, it's knowing what to do next in the view you have. He does not have to know why his car blew a tire at that time, but he needs to know how to skillfully get his disabled vehicle off the road without injury to people or property. He does not have to know why the lane ahead of him is barricaded, but he must know how to skillfully blend into the cars in the lane next to him. We can spend a lot of futile time thinking, now why is my husband like that? Why does he do that? Or why does my wife do that? Or why do my kids do this? Why are they doing this? And why are they doing that? Why would he come home and say this? And we'd spend all this time trying to figure out why, when really the wise thing to do is say, now what is the next right response for me? That's wisdom. Joseph in Genesis 39 never knew why he had to spend time in prison on a trumped-up charge of attempted rape. But he knew and practiced responses that kept him usable to God anyway. The patriarch Job never knew why all of his children and properties were wiped out in God's providence. But he knew and practiced responses that kept him usable to God anyway. The Apostle Paul never knew why God refused to remove his thorn in the flesh, but he knew and practiced responses that kept him usable to God anyway. The important lesson here is that wisdom is not having God's perspective of the whole matter before us, but having God's perspective about what next move will honor Him while keeping us still usable to Him. If I respond in anger and frustration and bitterness and despair, I'm no longer usable to God in that situation. I've crashed and burned on the runway. If you can face all of those situations and you know what next right move will keep you usable to God in this situation, that's what He's after, and that glorifies Him when we remain useful. And that's what the Bema seat is all about. It's whether or not God could use us in the circumstances we were in. And wisdom is knowing the next right move that keeps me usable to God, though everybody is bouncing off the guardrails and stuff in front of me, and maybe I even get hit from behind and hit somebody in front of me and all of this kind of thing. But a skillful driver, he will do whatever he can to keep as usable out there as he can. The goal of safe driving is to stay on the road in order to reach the destination. A skillful driver knows how to do that in most of the conditions that may confront him. Similarly, the goal of the Christian life is to stay on the path of usefulness to God no matter what the circumstances. Christians who are thrown off the road of usefulness by indulgences in their own flesh or by ungodly reactions of anxiety and anger and despair and frustration and bitterness, those who are thrown off the road by those reactions to calamity or to fleshly actions of others are not living wisely. Now, Solomon is telling us wisdom is better than prosperity. Notice in your notes this paragraph from Ketty. God-given wisdom, which is knowing the next right move, is the key to redeeming the multifaceted experiences of life. Solomon wants to emphasize that wisdom is a good thing which benefits those who see the sun or who are alive. How in a nutshell does this work out? Well, says Koheleth, or the preacher, it is a shelter. Wisdom is a shelter. Like, for example, money. You all know how having money can shelter you in a most practical way from nasty things like hunger and cold. Wisdom is like that. Only more so, for it preserves the life of its possessor, something money can't do. The point is that wisdom is a species of wealth that transcends the under-the-sun world and reaches to heaven. Or rather, true wisdom reaches from heaven, from the Lord, and equips the believer with the resources to live a full and God-honoring life. Listen, folks, we don't have to get bent out of shape that we can't seem to pass on to our children a great inheritance. We can teach them how to be wise. And that's far more valuable than any inheritance we could pass on. So he's going to tell us several things. Number one, wisdom gives life gives life or spiritual vitality. Notice verse 12. For wisdom is a defense and money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge or this wisdom is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Knowing the next right move is a defense. It keeps you safe. It would be like this. We could say, he who drives defensively stays out of many wrecks. You know, an old Chinese proverb. He who drives defensively stays out of many wrecks. He who lives wisely stays out of many problems. Wisdom is the best insurance policy. It is a defense. Number two, wisdom teaches how to respond to life's fluctuations. Chapter 13 and 14, consider the works of God. For who can make that straight, which he hath made crooked? If God wants something crooked, you think you can straighten it out? Not on your life. A lot of fluctuations. Verse 14, in the day of prosperity be joyful, but in the day of adversity consider. Think. It's interesting, isn't it, that he doesn't say in the day of adversity party? In the day of adversity watch a movie? In the day of adversity go listen to your music? In the day of adversity, go for a long drive or a hard run. He says, in the day of adversity, think, folks, think. God also has set the one over against the other to the end that man should find nothing after him. The wise response in prosperity is rejoice in what God has given you, but in adversity, reflect. In prosperity, rejoice. In adversity, reflect. Think about what's happening. Number three, wisdom allows you to weather life's injustices by keeping you from several things. Injustices, in verse 15, like the good man who dies early and the bad man who lives long. 15, all things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness. The good man dies. And there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his wickedness. That's the very verse, that's the very concept that girl was having trouble with about George Burns. Wisdom allows you to weather life's injustices by keeping you from self-righteousness. Verse 16, the first part, be not righteous over much. You might say, oh, that's great. Good, that means I can sin a little bit. That's not what it says. He's saying, in adversity, don't think yourself super righteous. That will kill you too. Don't think yourself super righteous. You can destroy yourself with that. By keeping you from self-sufficiency. Why should us, verse 17, be not over, excuse me. Neither make thy, verse 16, be, neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? You can destroy yourself by thinking you're too righteous, super righteous, or you, by being self-sufficient. And wisdom will keep you from both of those things, and it will also keep you from self-indulgence. Verse 17, be not overmuch wicked, neither be thou foolish. Why shouldest thou die before thy time? You can shortcut your life by self-indulgence too. In adversity, you can destroy yourself by being self-righteous, by being self-sufficient, or by being self-indulgent, and a wise man doesn't allow himself any of those things. Where does wisdom come from? Number four, he teaches us, wisdom comes from the fear of the Lord. Number four here in your notes, verse 18. Verse 18, he says, it is good that thou shouldest take hold of this, yea, also from this withdraw not thine hand, for he that feareth God shall come forth from them all. If you fear God and walk in wisdom, you can keep yourself from self-righteousness, self-sufficiency, and self-indulgence. Wisdom is a protection, it's insurance, it's a defense, he says. And this statement about the fear of the Lord foreshadows what is going to come along in chapter 12. We've heard some hints before of the fear of the Lord. It's going to be developed as we come to the conclusion of the book. Number five, wisdom allows you to see your own faults, not just those of others. And all of us need this. It is so easy for us to deceive ourselves and think, well, that's not my problem, when it really is. The only cure for self-deception is a lot of time in the Word. Because you can behold your face as in a glass, and you'll see what's there. And if you walk away and forget what manner of man you are, you'll stay in your self-deception. But if you'll see reflected there in that mirror what you are and go to God, you can be changed. Wisdom allows you to see your own faults, not just those of others. I already mentioned, he who drives wisely stays out of many wrecks. That's true about all of life, too. That's not just true for driving. It's very easy when you're out driving. If you are a very frustrated, in the hurry, can't wait kind of a person, to get very angry out there when people are getting in your way when you're driving. And we have things today like drive-by shootings and road rage. A foolish man spends his days honking at all the other bad drivers on the road. We have to ask ourselves, do I do that? Would my kids say that I spend most of my day honking at all the bad drivers in the house? A wise person doesn't drive with his horn. And a wise mother and a wise father doesn't drive with his anger. Just because there are other lousy drivers in the vicinity doesn't mean that you should add to it another one. You don't drive with your horn, and you don't drive with your anger. A wise man knows how to skillfully move through the traffic even when others are bad drivers. He still knows how to stay on the road. A mom who is wise still knows how to retain fellowship with God and testimony before her children, though they're doing their best to unravel her sanity. A wise mother knows how to do that. And a wise father knows how to do that as well. And if we're driving with our horns at mom and dad, honking them at mom and dad, or at the kids, or at each other in the marriage, we're demonstrating we are fools, we're not wise. Fools drive with their horns. Wise people know how to stay on the road even though there are bad drivers around him. Sometimes people say, well, you know, I guess, you know, I'm just a pessimist. I just see that, you know, there's just so much wrong going on. No, you know what? There's no such thing as a spiritually minded pessimist. Doesn't this whole book teach us that a man who has fellowship with God has joy in adversity? Doesn't 1 Peter 1 tell us that we have this living hope, this view of God in which we rejoice, though now if need be we are in heaviness through manifold temptations? You can have a heart full of heaviness about what is going on around you and still have a heart full of joy too. But God has to be in your sight. A person who is going around angry and disgruntled and dissatisfied and honking at all the other drivers is assuming the other drivers are the problem. Now they may have problems. Dr. Bob Sr. used to talk about the man with Limburger cheese in his beard. Old drunk, one night he's drunk out in the alley and one of his friends, supposed friends, comes and rubs Limburger cheese in his beard. Now, I've never smelled Limburger cheese, but I understand that's pretty putrid smelling stuff. And so he wakes up and sobers up a little bit and the whole world stinks. And he walks by a woman with a nice fur coat and she's radiating perfume, and he walks by and he looks at her, he smells her, she goes by and he says, she stinks. He picks a flower and he smells the flower and he says, the flower stinks too. And he goes into a tavern and he says, he throws down his buck and he says, give me a drink. And he says to the bartender, ain't it rotten? And the guy said, ain't what rotten? And he says, the whole world stinks. Well, if you got Limburger cheese in your beard, everything does stink. Dr. Bob Senior went on to say, he's talking to the students here, in one of his chapel messages, and he said, don't you go around here saying everybody stinks when it's your own smell smelling up everything else. He says, you go up to Dean of Men's office and you say, you know what, that Dean of Men stinks. And you know what, that teacher I had today, she stinks too. And I went to, and he says this, I went to see old man Bob Senior, and I sat in his office and he stinks, the whole world stinks. And Dr. Bob said, don't you go around here thinking everybody's stinking up when it's your own stink that's stinking it up for you. See, a wise person, a fool, is thinking that everybody else stinks, and it's probably the Limburger cheese in his own beard. The lesson of Ecclesiastes is when disappointments hit, get the point. God is saying, nothing truly does satisfy. Come to me. Don't spend your life honking at all the bad drivers. Learn to drive skillfully through the frustrating situations of life. Wisdom will allow you to do that. Number 6. Wisdom allows you to escape the snares of sin. Verses 23 to 26. By the way, if any of you that I know anything about think I'm talking about you, these are in my notes for the last 10 years. If it seems applicable to you, it's purely intentional by God. Okay? Verse 23 to 26, and this have I proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I applied mine heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find it more bitter than death. Verse 26, yes. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands is bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Now, Solomon, some people looked at it and said, Solomon is against women. Solomon is not against women, folks. This man is not against women. Now, he may not have... I mean, I would imagine if you're one of 1,000, you might think he is against you. And that may be true, I don't know. But this is not some woman hater talking here, because he's got quite a harem. This is a personification of evil here. And wisdom allows you to escape the snares of death. He's talked about in Proverbs 5 and 7 about the woman who snares with her looks and so forth, and how the fool goes into her. And he says, wisdom allows you to escape the snares of sin. Wisdom allows you to see man's real problem. Verses 27 to 29. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among 1,000 have I found, but a woman among all those I have not found. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. He's saying, not many people are wise. They want to go their own way. God made them upright and righteous. Adam departed for his own way. And they've sought out many other ways to make it work, and they've forgotten the batteries. They're pushing their truck around. They're making motor sounds with their mouth. They're doing all things, kind of things, to make the truck work the way it's supposed to work. But what they just need to do is find the batteries. Wisdom fundamentally changes a man so that his face shines and his face softens. Chapter 8, verse 1. Who is as the wise man, and who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine. You know what that means? It means he's visibly gracious. And the boldness of his face shall be changed. The word boldness there means hardness. There's not a hardness about his face. He's not hard, he's not tough. Wisdom fundamentally changes a man. Number 9. He says, wisdom teaches you how to deal with authority. He says, for example, be attentive to the words of your king. When your king, an authority in your life, speaks to you, listen to him. Verse 2, I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment and that in regard of the oath of God. You've given your word before God that you would obey. Do it. Listen to the king. Obey the king. Don't be quick to run off in a huff. Verse 3, be not hasty to go out of his sight. You know, folks, there's probably nothing that tests our wisdom more than our response to the kings in our life. Because in many respects, the kings of our life are out of our control. What they do is out of our comprehension. You say, you just described my whatever. No, God says, you show your wisdom by how you respond to the kings in your life. If you walk out in a huff on your king, you're showing you're a fool. A wise man knows how to drive in that kind of traffic. I think it's amazing today how many people insult their king when they're trying to get their king to do something good for them. I see that all the time. I will have a dad call me for an exception about something, you know, and the first thing out of his mouth is, I don't suppose you do this kind of thing down there. Well, if you're trying to get somebody to do you a favor, don't insult them to start with. I had a student, he really honestly was 3 fries short of a happy meal. I mean, he really was. This has been some years ago, but he had been into a lot of cocaine and heroin, got saved, but it really did leave him, it really did burn out part of his thinking processes, and everything didn't connect. And we were trying harder to keep him in school than he was trying to stay in school. And for freshman orientation, I teach freshman orientation, and I have all of the students go through a tour of our art gallery. I mean, it's a beautiful, wonderful art gallery. And so I have them fill out a schedule card of when they are free so I can assign them to a tour in groups of 20. And then I send the cards out to their mailboxes, and then they're supposed to show up for the tour at that time and so forth. Well, this boy, I'll call him Fred. I can't remember what his name was, but Fred came up just before class. There was a bunch of students. They'd all got assignments, and there were some conflicts with something that had come up now, and they wanted to know what to do. And so there were probably 15 students around the front of the class, and I was down on the main floor talking with them about that. And Fred comes up, and he kind of pushes himself. He didn't have a lot of social awareness or social skills. And he pushes himself in front of everybody, and he says, Dr. Berg, I got a problem. You put me in this class. I'm in this class right now. And I'm also supposed to be at the art gallery right now. Which one do you want me to do? I said, well, Fred, if you're put in that class, if you're put in art gallery tour during this class, that means that you gave this class as your free hour. He said, that's right. This is the only free hour I have for orientation. I said, no, this is your class hour. I need another hour outside of that. He said, no, you don't understand. This is the only free hour I have to do orientation. And this brought all these other things. I said, Fred, no, you don't understand. You have to be in this class. I'll assign you to another time outside of this class. Give me your free hours, and I'll say. He said, no, you don't understand. And then he looked at me, and he said, I see I'm not getting anywhere with you. And he turned and walked around. And all the students down in the front were going, whoa, you know. And I said to them, I'll talk to Fred later. You know, now Fred had some other problems that were, you know, that I think made this situation a little bit worse. But You know, isn't it pretty common these days, if you want something from your king, just rip him up, as if that's going to make him any more kindly disposed toward you? That is the way of a fool. And Solomon says, listen to your king and don't run off in a huff. Don't be disloyal to your king. Remember, he rules. He says, part B in verse 3, stand not in an evil thing. Don't get involved in an insurrection. For he doeth whatever pleaseth him. When it's all said and done, he has the final word. Where the word of the king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? In the end, folks, he's going to rule. So, you know, don't be disloyal to him. Don't run off in a huff. Wise people know how to drive in that kind of traffic. Learn wisely to handle the ups and downs of living with your king. Verses 5 to 7. Whoso keepeth the commandments shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. He knows when and where to do what he needs to do. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment, therefore the misery of man is great upon him. For he knoweth not that which shall be, for who can tell him when it shall be? You may not know when the next curve is going to come in the road, but a wise man will know the right time and the right decision to make at that, when he needs it. And he says another thing a wise man is able to do is recognize the ruler's limitations. Verse 8, there is no man that hath power over the spirit to retain the spirit, neither hath he power in the day of death, and there is no discharge in that war, neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. Now, what does all that mean? Well, look at your notes there. Point A, it means he has some limitations. He can't imprison your spirit. I tell the students, folks, young people, nobody, you can never be ruined by somebody else's decisions. Did I talk about that here? You can never be ruined by somebody else's decisions. You can only be ruined by your own. People can make a decision here to harm your body, but that doesn't have to poison your soul. You're only ultimately ruined by your own decisions. You know, Joseph, here he is, a 17-year-old boy, about the time of life everybody wants to make their own decisions. And his brothers make a decision that make a lot of decisions for him. They choose his major. You know, these guys, he didn't even get to choose his major. How can you expect me to be a success in life when I don't even get to choose my major? They chose his address, where he's going to live. He dreamed about a condo tent on the Sea of Galilee. You know, now he's down in slaves' quarters down in Egypt. Somebody else made that decision. They decide what station in life he's going to have. He is the next heir as the prince of the clan in his family. And he's top dog in the totem pole coming up next, and now he's right there with the same status level as an ox, somebody else's animal property. So, well, I thought he was in the house, you know, as the steward. That's where he ended up. That's not where he started. That slave trader took them down there, put him on a slave block. You don't find Egyptian lords going over the slave block and saying, you know what, I think I want that guy to run my house. You don't do that. He starts in the quarries, or he starts in the fields, or he starts emptying latrines for him or something, but that's where he starts. And it's by his wise handling of those situations that he gets promoted. He's driving skillfully through all of this stuff. And his brothers decide the language he's going to have to listen to. They decide what his prospects of marriage are going to be. They decide that he's not going to be around any friends. They decide he's not going to be around his dad. They make a lot of decisions for him. And you know what? None of those have to ruin anybody. You can't ever be ruined by somebody else's decisions. But you can be destroyed by your own. Because you can sit back and make decisions in your mind about their decisions. That is an absolute stupid decision. If I were running this show, I wouldn't do that.
That will destroy you. You can never be ruined by somebody else's decisions. If you're ruined, it was your choice. And you have to recognize the ruler's limitations. He says he cannot imprison your spirit. He can't touch the important part of you. He cannot rule death, point B. Point C, he can't stop the battles of life. Point D, he can't make a wicked thing turn out right. There are a lot of things the king can't do. And he says, reality is, nonetheless, people are going to get hurt by their kings. Verse 9, all this have I seen and applied my heart unto work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. We live on a fallen planet, and you can't avoid getting hurt by other people. But you can learn how to drive skillfully down that road. And he says also another thing, sometimes the wicked are even praised and honored because the king doesn't handle evildoers correctly. And that's right. Sometimes the wicked don't get what's coming to them. We see some evil man acquitted in the courts and he earns millions by his books. You know, from a human standpoint, it's absolutely galling that former President Clinton, can earn $1 million on one speech. Whoa! I mean, if you think about that very much, that's a real goad. You know? And evildoer, the wicked are even praised and honored because the king doesn't handle evildoers correctly. And in this case, the courts and in our Congress. But understand ultimately that evil doing is wisely settled by God. Verses 12 to 14. I didn't read verse 10 and 11. Verse 10 and 11. And so I saw the wicked buried. Here's a wicked man honored by a proper burial, who had come and had gone from the place of the holy, from Jerusalem, and they were forgotten. Or that better word there is praised in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. When the wicked aren't handled right, it makes it hard for a whole lot of people. Verse 12. This is understanding that ultimately evil doing is wisely settled by God. 12 to 14. Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and his days be prolonged, that surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not before God. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men upon whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. In other words, the just get the wrong thing. And again, there be a wicked man to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that also is vanity. They said, remember, it's going to turn out right for the person who fears God. Ultimately, it's going to turn out right. Understand the ultimate end of things. So the conclusion here, the conclusion of Discourse 3, look at verse 15. Then I commended mirth. He said, look, I realize, you know, it's we can be joyful all in all of this, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. That means to be content and satisfied, for that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. He's back to the same theme. The conclusion is, God will give enjoyment and contentment and wisdom to those who fear him. The conclusion in your notes say, true wisdom is never divorced from the words and the work of God. Koheleth, or the preacher, is a theocentric anti-abstractionist. What that means is a God-centered realist. For him, wisdom does not derive from age, intelligence, or experience in themselves, but from the interaction of the directive, revealed truth of God and the responsive human mind and heart. Any of us can learn the next right move that will keep us useful to God in all of these fluctuations of life. What we have to remember is that the batteries are not included. If you look really closely at the box, there is a little sign down at the bottom that says, batteries not included. And that's the whole theme of Ecclesiastes when he's talking to these philosophers, and we're learning from this as well. That you get this truck, this is a secret of prosperity. You think getting the truck will make it work, will make life work for you, but not if you don't have the batteries. It's the wisdom that makes it work. Lord Jesus, we pray that we might be sensitive to how foolish we often are. And we're so quick to even defend our foolishness. I pray that as you put your finger on the areas of our life where we are living life apart from you, I pray that you would teach us and instruct us and help us to be humble before you. Thank you that you are so willing to take, as you said in 1 Corinthians, the poor of this world and the unknown in this world and the things that are not, and you are willing to make them confound the things that are. But it's your wisdom that will make that difference, and we need those batteries. And we turn to you for our help. Thank you for teaching us, we pray in your name.